The Trumpet Daily Program begins right now.
Today's world news, what it means, where it's taking us.
I bring you the one and only possible message of world peace.
This is a message of hope, tremendous hope. And he said unto me, you must prophesy again.
And now, The Trumpet Daily with Stephen Flurry.
Hello again, everyone, and welcome back to the Trumpet Daily Radio Show. We have a lot to get to on today's program, a lot going on in the news, and also we have a study later on today's show where we'll continue with something we discussed yesterday, a little bit about Winston Churchill and his love for history, and we'll talk about how that we can really cultivate a love for history and for our roots, whether physical or spiritual. We really do need to cultivate that love for history within the family. There's so many passages of scripture. We'll look at one passage today that talks about just how important it is to teach our young people, our children, to remind them of their own history, to remind them of the legacy that they're carrying out. As I say, we'll get into that a little bit later on in the show. We've got some really good sound bites to go with it from American historian David McCullough, so stay tuned for that. Well, last night, President Trump nominated Judge Brett Kavanaugh for the open seat on the Supreme Court, and liberal activists were quick to rally at the court, protesting outside the Supreme Court as soon as the announcement was made. Speakers there saying that this nominee, this judge that President Trump is putting forward, he poses a threat to abortion rights. That's what it always boils down to. And healthcare protections, that kind of thing. Fox News, I noticed, had a crew that was going to be reporting outside the Supreme Court, but they pulled out and moved into an indoor studio. Because, as the reporter said, it was just too volatile out there with the protesters. There was another headline that said ABC started railing against the nominee even before he was announced. So they were ready with their hysterical reaction, even before they knew who it was. As I said on yesterday's show, I played the montage for you yesterday, what they were saying all through the last several days. This is an attack on the Constitution. We're going to have to fight this. You heard some of that yesterday. Here's a bit from Brett Kavanaugh last night after accepting the president's nomination, clip 11.
My judicial philosophy is straightforward. A judge must be independent and must interpret the law, not make the law. A judge must interpret statutes as written, and a judge must interpret the Constitution as written, informed by history and tradition and precedent.
So he seems like a fairly conservative judge. Of course, you have to kind of wait and see with so many of them. You just don't know for sure. But you certainly know how the Democrats are going to attack this process. Senator Jeff Merkley of Oregon, he said this nomination tonight is all about power over the people. He said, I can tell you this is the most political of possible appointments. This is a nominee who wants to pave the path to tyranny. He wants to pave the path to tyranny. This is not some, you know, left-wing kook that's out there protesting. This is a senator in Congress. Well, go back and read Chapter 1 of America Under Attack. I won't spend a lot of time on this. I'll leave it to the other pundits. I'm sure they'll have plenty to say all through today. But go back and read Chapter 1 of America Under Attack, the hidden cause of society's deadly decline. We went through this a couple of weeks ago when Justice Kennedy announced his retirement. We went back through that history from 30, 31 years ago when Robert Bork had been nominated. And the way that they demonized him, the way that they attacked him, I mean, that, as it turns out, that was the seat that Justice Kennedy eventually filled. Bork went on to write about how the whole process had been politicized. He wrote it in his book there in the late 1980s, The Tempting of America. And if you thought that it was bad then, well, wait and see what plays out this time around, or with the next one, perhaps. Or what if Kavanaugh doesn't get confirmed? And then it's another round of fighting. And then you've got the midterm elections thrown in the middle of it all. Lots of division. And you see it here in the UK as well, as I said yesterday. Boris Johnson resigned shortly after we finished the program yesterday. He had served as Theresa May's foreign secretary. And he sends out a much publicized resignation letter saying that the UK was headed for a semi-Brexit. It's not for real. It's not a break like the voters wanted. It's an arrangement where the UK is essentially a colony of Brussels. That's what Mr. Johnson said in his resignation letter. And, of course, his resignation follows right on the heels of the Brexit secretary, David Davis, on Sunday. Now, Mr. Davis evidently still backs Mrs. May's leadership. There hasn't been as much vocal support coming from Boris Johnson. But Melanie Phillips, writing about the turmoil here in the UK politically, she says, with the resignations of David Davis and Boris Johnson, both the Chequers agreement and Mrs. May's government are now disintegrating by the minute. This agreement that they made at Chequers, that's sort of like the UK equivalent of Camp David. They made the agreement at Chequers, and now it's disintegrating by the minute, just like Mrs. May's government. Melanie Phillips says here, according to the most vociferous Remainers, Brexit voters are bigots and imbeciles who didn't understand what they were voting for, didn't grasp the problematic consequences, and didn't vote to leave the EU single market or customs union. So they're just bigots and imbeciles. They didn't know what they were doing. They're stupid. And this is what they're saying from the radical left in the United States as well. Well, there was a Daily Mail piece. I guess this was on a recent survey that said even more Britons want to leave the EU, with nearly 15%, an increase of 15% since the referendum just 2 years ago. So here again, you have the arguing back and forth among the elites, and then you have just the general populace, and they're up in arms. I mean, what is wrong with our political institutions? Well, as far as Brexit is concerned, you know well what Herbert Armstrong said as far back as 1956, when he said that Germany would dominate the coming United States of Europe, but that Britain would not be a part of it. And he reiterated this even at the very end of his life in Mystery of the Ages. And this is a prophecy that we picked up on right away. And you've seen it in the trumpet over the years. Britain will not be a part of that final arrangement of the European Union. This was one of the key prophecies that Herbert Armstrong made, certainly regarding Europe. Germany as the leader of a United States of Europe, and Britain, of course, not being part of it. And so we watch closely what's happening here in Britain with respect to the EU. And of course, our eyes are fixed on Germany in Europe as well. Chancellor Merkel's government, well, as you've heard on the Trumpet Hour and elsewhere, she's reached an arrangement or an agreement to just hold the coalition together. But she's losing power and influence by the day. The Times of London this morning, it reported that the migration row that nearly brought down her government has boosted the far right. That's the AfD party, the Alternative for Deutschland party. And right now, according to the polls, they're running neck and neck with the Social Democrats. So you have the majority, the CDU, CSU, the two sister parties, the conservatives. The election last September, the conservatives picked up almost 33% of the vote. And then the SPD followed behind that at 20.5%. And then a distant third, although it was a big chunk, for this far-right party, the AFD, got 12.6% of the vote. That's just less than a year ago. And now, according to this recent poll, it's showing the AFD running neck and neck with the Social Democrats, the SPD party that got 20.5%. The Times says here, with crucial Bavarian regional elections taking place in 3 months, the AFD has achieved a record level of support at 17%. On a par with Germany's center-left party, which is in coalition with Mrs. Merkel. So going back to the division among the conservatives, I mean, you can see why Horst Seehofer is in such a difficult position, because he wants a stronger stance on immigration. Because he knows the AFD, they're picking up more of the votes in Bavaria. So they want Merkel to clamp down. And that's what all this division and fighting is over. Meanwhile, you've got more progress being made for the EU and its future military or army. Of course, they've been in talks and agreements and made arrangements and alliances for some time now. We've been following this, of course, for years, and there still is work to be done for sure. But this article at the Times this morning talks about how NATO plans a borderless EU for troop movements, for tanks and such. Britain and its NATO allies are poised to slash the red tape and bureaucracy that prevents troops from crossing European nations at speed to deter Russian aggression. And so here again, we look at this and we just project ahead. Where is this headed? Where is this leading? The plan, it says, led by the Netherlands, will reduce to 5 days from as many as 40 the time it takes for a military commander to gain permission from the civilian authorities of a member state to travel with tanks, soldiers, and ammunition through their country. It talks about how that this is, well, it's being referred to as a sort of military Schengen. The Schengen being, you know, the borderless Europe where you can travel, you know, throughout the Union without having to stop at a border check every time you come into a new nation. It's very convenient for citizens, and they want this same kind of convenience for military activity as well. So when it does finally downsize to the Ten Kings, as Revelation 17 prophesies, well, you can see God preparing this Assyrian rod, as Isaiah 10 brings out. God's going to use the rod of his anger, as it says there, to correct, to punish an hypocritical nation, as it says in Isaiah chapter 10, verses 5 and 6. One last item here. We've also been talking at length over the last 2 years about the future trade war. Really, it's already here. This piece at the GermanForeignPolicy.com, it says, as the first German car maker, BMW, draws consequences from the trade war initiated by U.S. President Donald Trump. It says, as the company announced yesterday, it will expand its production in China to avoid losses that Chinese countervailing duties are likely to impose on U.S. punitive tariffs. If the car company had previously sold vehicles produced in the USA to the People's Republic, it will in the future reduce deliveries from its U.S. locations to China and at the same time transform its location in Shenyang into a factory also producing for export. It says the decision increases the importance of the People's Republic for the long-term planning of the group. So you see Germany, BMW to be specific, entering into a more convenient trade relationship with China, getting around the United States as a result of this trade war. Go back to the Trumpet magazine, a little over a year ago, April 2017. Our headline was, trade wars have begun. I mean, they've started. They've started. This is President Trump's trade policy. It really is upsetting the global order. And as I've been saying, I mean, the U.S., because of a strong economy, may have the upper hand here in the short run. But again, we've got to take a long-term view here. As Brad McDonald wrote in April last year, he said the World Trade Order is currently being reconfigured in an astonishing way. This transformation is already impacting trade relations and facets of some economies, but soon it will significantly impact every national economy. It will spread, this war, and the players in this war, the actors in this war. Donald Trump has made it clear, America comes first. And, well, if you look at Germany, the strongest economy in Europe, I mean, when it comes to trade wars, they have a lot to lose, and so does China. And so as we've discussed with that Mart of Nations prophecy, Isaiah 23, it's the nations outside of the U.S. and Britain, it's the nations all around the world that are going to come together in order to collectively be able to freeze out the United States and Britain. So that's what we look for prophetically. You're listening to Stephen Fleury, and this is the Trumpet Daily Radio Show. If you'd like to email the program, you can send comments to td@kpcg.fm. When we come back, we'll get into our study about a love, or learning to love, history. We'll be right back.
This is KPCG-FM, and this is the Trumpet Daily. Are we living in the last days? Some dismiss the notion as fanatical, but world leaders and news analysts are issuing warnings that are becoming more and more dire. Could Bible prophecies about the last days actually be accurate? Our brochure can help guide you through the relevant news and history and help you compare these events to what the Bible says. Are we living in the last days? This brochure is available for free right now at thetrumpet.com. From the Philadelphia Church of God campus in Edstone, England, this is the Trumpet Daily Program with Stephen Fleury.
We are, in my view, in a crisis condition. We are becoming, at the age level, let's say, below 40 years old, of an historically illiterate nation.
That's a U.S. historian, David McCullough, a much younger David McCullough. That was back in 1993, some 25 years ago. And Mr. McCullough, he's been sounding the alarm ever since. And really, nothing has changed for the better. If anything, it's much worse today. I mean, this is a historian who's lectured at probably hundreds of colleges and universities over the past 30, 35 years. And as when he gets on these lecture circuits, he comments, it seems, at every stop about the young people today. And of course, the young people back in 93, well, they're adults today. They're the ones in their 30s or 40s or 50s. But he says that everywhere that he goes, he's just shocked at how little they know about their own history. And as he also says, it's not the children's fault. It's the fault of the parents and the teachers and the professors. That little snippet, again, historically illiterate. That's how he saw the United States back in 1993. If you fast forward to the year 2000, or sorry, the year 2005, this is a testimony before, I believe, the Senate. Again, this takes you back 13 years or so. And here's David McCullough at Congress. This is clip 3.
I think the problem is essentially that we've been teaching our teachers the wrong way. We have too many teachers who have graduated with degrees in education, and they are assigned to teach history or biology or mathematics or English literature, and they don't know the subject.
Problem, as he said, is with the teachers. It goes back before that, though, as I said with the previous clip. The parents certainly have to shoulder some of the blame, a lot of the blame. But he's certainly right about the teachers, those that have degrees, let's say, in education, but they don't really know history. They don't really love history. I can remember my 11th grade year in high school. My history teacher was the girls' varsity basketball coach. And he was there as the varsity basketball coach first. And as the history teacher second. And it tells you a little bit of something about the priorities. That was back in the late 1980s. Sports first and then history second. And I can tell you that class didn't do a lot to really inspire me. It certainly didn't do a lot to get me excited about history. And it was an American history course. Well, Mr. McCullough, he's made the rounds, as I say, saying that family too, parents, grandparents, we have to talk about history to our children. We have to talk about the books and the documents and the long-form articles that we love and that have impacted us, the biographies, the histories. History, he has said, is a source of strength. And again, you can look into the Bible if you want to draw some spiritual parallels and see the same thing. Jesus said, "You shall know the truth, and the truth shall make you free." That's a verse we read often on this program. In fact, we've talked a lot in recent weeks about the fight for truth, just to get to the truth of the matter. But the first part of that verse says, "And you shall know the truth." You have to get to know it. You have to get to really know the truth. That's the only way that you'll come to love the truth. You look at the prophecy in 2 Thessalonians 2, where God says, because of this great falling away from the truth, he sent strong delusion to test our love for the truth. You can't really love what you don't know. I mean, the two are joined together. It works the same way when you're getting to know someone, well, just a friend in college or at work or your spouse, someone at school. How do you get to know them? How do you come to love them? Assuming it's a spouse, let's say, how do you come to love that individual? You love them by how much you know them. You shall know the truth. And the truth shall make you free. God's truth is what frees us. And he says we've got to know it. We've got to really love it. We have to love and know the material that we're given, the truth that we're given. Because, well, we're not only responsible for teaching our children, but God's people are going to be teaching all of mankind in the world tomorrow. And if we don't know the material, if we aren't sold on it ourselves, if we don't love it ourselves, how effective will we be as a teacher? Here's David McCullough again from 2005. This is clip 4.
Anybody who, trying to teach a subject they don't know is right away got a problem. But it's also impossible to love what you don't know, just as it's impossible to love someone you don't know. And we all know from our experience in school, those of us who were lucky enough to have wonderful teachers, the best teachers were the teachers that were really excited about what they were teaching.
Now, all of us can identify with that. I had some excellent teachers as well when I was younger, leaving aside the history teacher from 11th grade. But there were some really good ones along the way, too, that did inspire. And he's right. He's right. Wonderful teachers. The ones who were really excited about what they were teaching. The ones who really loved what they were teaching. And if we're going to help our children, our young people, to love the truth, we have to love it ourselves first. Look at the Laodiceans, as I say. 2 Thessalonians 2, Revelation 3. They didn't love the truth. It says in Matthew 24 that their love waxed cold. The truth, their history, all of it just became cold, dry facts to them. Look at the ancient Israelites. They didn't love their history. Moses told them over and again, don't you forget this. Tell this to your children. Tell them about the miracles. But they didn't love it. And so they forgot it. We can actually look at this example. This is from Deuteronomy chapter 32. It's such an important point to make, whether you're looking at your own national history or obviously with respect to what's happened in the church. People today are perishing spiritually because they don't love the truth. They don't love it enough to get to know it, to study it. Look at what Moses says here in Deuteronomy 32. He says in verse 7, this is what tends to happen from generation to generation. Remember the days of old, consider the years of many generations. Consider the years of many, multiple generations, Moses says. You make sure that you can go way back in your knowledge and awareness and love for history. Ask your father, it says, and he will show you. See, they're both engaged, the children and the parents and the elders, and they will tell you. You better go and ask. You better go and get this education. You better go and be reminded of this precious truth. Ask, and the teachers will tell you. Down in verse 12, it says, so the Eternal alone did lead them, and there was no strange God with him. He made him ride on the high places of the earth, that he might eat the increase of the fields, and he made him to suck honey out of the rock and out of the flinty rock, butter of kine, verse 14. This is Israel's history. Milk of sheep with fat of lambs, and rams of the breed of Bashan, and goats with the fat of kidneys of wheat. All of these blessings. But it says in verse 15, but Jeshurun, or Israel waxed fat and kicked. You are waxing fat, it says. You are grown thick. You are covered with fatness. And then he forsook God, which made him and lightly esteemed the rock of his salvation. See, look at what we've done with all of these blessings, with all of this prosperity. Well, we've just come to take it for granted. I gave another program recently about the importance of giving God thanks and praise and not taking these blessings for granted. And even in our prayers, I mean, when we're going before God and thanking him for all of these benefits that he's just loaded upon us, I mean, that in itself is keeping those things in mind, bringing those things into remembrance, all that God has done. But what happens when you forget about that or when you're not thankful? Well, you just take it for granted and you live in the moment. Here again is David McCullough, the historian, from June 30th, 2005, clip 5.
And this could be exciting. This could bring young people and their teachers into a love of history, which is essential. If we raise generation after generation of young Americans who are historically illiterate, we're running a terrible risk for this country. You can have amnesia of a society, which is as detrimental as amnesia of an individual. And of course, if people begin to think that all that we have, all the blessings, our freedoms, our art, our music, our literature, our great institutions, the faith, the creed we have that has held us together for 229 years in equality, and the idea that all men are created equal, the ideal of life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness, of all of that seems to be something that just fell out of the sky, that it's just part of the natural world and that nobody struggled for it. There's no story behind it. Then we are really, in my view, in the soup. Jefferson said it perfectly. He said, any nation that expects to be ignorant and free expects what never was and never can be. Our very freedoms depend on education, and that's why education has been a sustaining theme, one of the great guidelines all through our history, from the time of the founders down to the present. And we're falling down. The literacy rate in Massachusetts in 1776, I'm sorry to say, was higher than it is today. We are raising children who don't know who George Washington was.
That was David McCullough 13 years ago. The literacy rate in Massachusetts in 1776. As primitive as we think that age to be, we're so enlightened today, and we're not even literate. We're certainly not historically literate. We don't know who George Washington was. All that we know, you heard it on the montage I played a while back, Prager University. All that we know is that he owned slaves. And so we've got to remove him. We've got to change those things, those institutions that are named after him. Ignorance and arrogance of the highest order. Jefferson said it. What a brilliant quote. Any nation that expects to be ignorant and free expects what never was and never can be. We can't maintain what we have or hold on to the freedoms we enjoy if we're living in ignorance. It works in the spiritual sense and the physical. The proverb says, train up a child in the way that he should go, and when he's old, he won't depart from it. I mean, how important is education and training and teaching and understanding and history? The Proverbs also talk about going after it, seeking after it like fine rubies and precious gold. Wisdom and understanding and knowledge. That's what you get with a study of the past. And look at how much joy that also comes along with it. I mean, there's so much joy and happiness to be gleaned from a study of our own spiritual roots, our physical roots. George Washington, the founding fathers. Back up to Deuteronomy 11, verse 1 here. Notice this. It says, therefore, you shall love the Eternal your God and keep his charge and his statutes and his judgments and his commandments always. Love God. You get to love God by knowing him. By knowing everything about him. Love the Lord your God. Obey his commandments, his charge. Verse 2 says, and know you this day, for I speak not with your children, which have not known and which have not seen the chastisement of the Eternal your God, his greatness, his mighty hand, and his stretched out arm. I mean, know this. Make sure you learn these lessons. Your children aren't here to see it, or they're not old enough yet to understand it. But you better make sure that you get it. Mark this day, Moffat says. Mark it. Draw attention to it. Put it down in your journal. Pray about it. Discuss it with your family. It says again to the adults, verse 7, but your eyes have seen all the great acts of the Eternal which he did. Therefore shall you keep all the commandments which I command you this day, that you may be strong and go in and possess the land, whether you go to possess it. Here again, he's addressing the parents directly, saying that you've seen all these miracles. You've experienced these miracles. Down in verse 18, it says, therefore shall you lay up these my words in your heart and in your soul and bind them for a sign upon your hand, that you may be that they may be as frontlets between your eyes. In other words, don't ever forget them. Make sure that as adults, you never forget. And then verse 19, it says, and you shall teach them to your children, speaking of them, when you sit in your house, and when you walk by the way, and when you lie down, and when you rise up. I mean, that's what Mr. McCullough's getting at. Look, you've got parents, grandparents. You've got to teach them. You've got to talk about it. You've got to talk about it around the dinner table. It's not like this isn't a problem that can't be solved. As he said, go back to some of the basics. This is from that same testimony. Let's move ahead to clip 8.
So it isn't that this is a problem we can't solve. This is a problem we absolutely can solve. Go back to some basics, back to a good liberal arts education for everybody who teaches in our public schools, number one, and encourage those who want to teach history to major in history, and encourage those who teach history to give their students things to read that they themselves, all the rest of us, would also want to read. And never underestimate their capacity to be pulled in by wonderful writing about great subjects.
Wonderful writing about great subjects. There's so much of it out there. And yet, why are young people today so utterly disinterested in the lessons of history? Well, it says a lot about the educational institutions. It says a lot about the ignorance among the adults. Again, you look at the warning he sounded in 1993. Where are those young people today? If they were ignorant back then, and they're 40 or 50, and their children are 15. Well, notice this one last point he made in that same testimony, clip 9.
One other quick point, Senator. I don't think we should leave the job to the federal government or to the teachers. I think in many ways, as my daughter Dori Lawson said at dinner one night to us, the trouble with American education is us. We who are parents and grandparents, we've got to do more to talk about history with our children. We've got to reinstate the dinner table conversation. We've got to reinstate dinner. And we have to take them to those historic sites ourselves. Don't wait for the school trip. Senator Kennedy has been taking his nieces and nephews and many of his family to historic places year after year. It's a wonderful family tradition. It ought to be a family tradition everywhere, because those trips can change your life. I was taken to Monticello by a school pal and his mother and father on spring vacation when I was about 14. And I know it changed my life. It's what started me down the trail in my interest in history. And we should be giving our children the books that we liked when we were just discovering history at whatever level. That should all be part of it. And you, who are people in public prominence, can do wonders individually, not just in your role as representatives in the government. You can set a standard conspicuously of parental or grandparental involvement in what ought to be something we all enjoy talking about. Now, some young families will say, you don't understand, there's not enough time anymore for that. I can't find that acceptable when you read that the average American family spends 3 to 4 hours a day watching television. Surely there's time to have a common interest with your children or grandchildren about the history of this country.
Some wise words there from a historian, and one that's not even that conservative. He's just speaking truth. And he's written some wonderful works over the years. And he's pleading his case, begging for grandparents and parents to take it upon themselves to fix the problem. I mean, that's where you have to start. It's in the family. That's why those words are so wise. This is not idealistic or impractical. In fact, it's the most practical solution there is. It really is the solution to all of the problems of our world. Family living. Right family living. Moses said it in Deuteronomy 11. Teach them to your children and be consistent and be diligent and repeat it over and again so that they get to know it, so that they get to love it. Write it on the doorposts. Put it upon the gates. Give them monuments to look at. Go visit the monuments. It can have quite an impact. I mentioned the visit even we had just recently down to Chartwell. That was sort of connected with a group reading, going through Manchester's work on Churchill, and then finishing it off. We're blessed enough to be right here in the UK, just 2.5 hours away from Churchill's residence from the 1920s and 30s and on after World War II even. And you visit it after you read the passages in Manchester, the way that he paced back and forth in his office with the secretary sitting down, just plucking away at the typewriter. And you can envision it. It leaves an impact. Verse 21 of this passage in Deuteronomy 11, that your days may be multiplied and the days of your children in the land which the Eternal swear unto your fathers to give to you. I mean, this is how your family gets stronger. This is how you bring blessings and prosperity into your lives. Don't forget about your history. I mentioned yesterday on the show that article my father wrote in Royal Vision. Well, it goes back to a lecture he gave a year ago, Seven Keys for Building Leadership. He used the example of Winston Churchill and just how grounded that young man, how grounded he was in history. I had an email that came in, by the way, in response to yesterday's show where we talked about Manchester's biography and my father really admonishing us to, well, he didn't come right out and say, definitely go read this cover to cover. But he talked about how unique Manchester's work is compared to other biographies about Winston Churchill. And this listener wrote me today saying, enjoyed the show yesterday, twice. I don't seem to absorb all that much with the first go-round. I was listening to you speaking about reading in general and Manchester in particular and was stirred to action. So in the spirit of, why don't you just do what the minister said to for once, I biked over to the library and checked out Volume 1, and I'm sure glad I did. I can't remember the last time I've laughed this much over the first 14 pages of a book. What an attitude that man had. He knew war was the norm, peace the aberration, and he just accepted it, prepared for it, and prepared the people. Having been a lifelong coward, it's really hard for me to conceive of what that mindset must be like. But hopefully someday I'll find out. Cheers and thanks so much. Looking forward to more great KPCG programming tomorrow. 14 pages. 14 pages. It's not just the education. It's not just an awareness of what happened back in those days. It's the enjoyment. It's getting to know someone who really did have some qualities of leadership that we're aiming for. Those of us in God's church, those of us supporting God's work. I mean, Churchill was concerned about saving the Western world. And God calls his people in the book of Obadiah saviors. This is what my father was discussing in that article. Seven Keys for Building Leadership. I wish I brought it down here with me. I read through it again this morning. It's a powerful article, Royal Vision, November, December, 2017. If you don't have a subscription to Royal Vision, contact our headquarters office and ask to subscribe. What an uplift. Infinite pleasure, as David McCullough said. Here's another clip from that 2005 testimony, clip 6.
Will knowing history make one a better citizen? Absolutely. Will knowing history give us a sense of who we are and how we got to be where we are and why we are the way we are? Absolutely. But history is also a source of pleasure. It is a source of infinite pleasure, the way art and music and literature are. And to deny our children that pleasure is to deny them a means of extending and enlarging the experience of being alive. Why would anyone want to be provincial in time any more than to be provincial in space, when the whole realm of the human experience is there for our enjoyment as well as our enlightenment? Harry Truman said the only new thing in the world is the history you don't know. Daniel Boorstin, who wrote the great one-volume history textbook of the United States and who was himself a front rank historian and the Librarian of Congress, said trying to plan for the future without a sense of the past is like trying to plant cut flowers. And we're trying to plant thousands of cut flowers, and it isn't going to work.
That's David McCullough from testimony before Congress in 2005, talking about how knowing history, just knowing history, will make you a better citizen. It'll give you a better sense of who you are and how you got to be where you are. And it's also a source of infinite pleasure in the same way that music and literature are. The only new thing in the world is the history you don't know. That's from Harry Truman, who wasn't like this incredibly educated president as far as scholarly education goes, but he studied history his entire life. So many of the great presidents of old have done that. One final clip here from that same testimony. Here's clip 7.
Samuel Eliot Morison, the great Harvard historian, said, "History teaches us how to behave." I feel so strongly about this, but I also know that the problem can be solved. There is no trick to it. Barbara Tuchman said you can do it. She explained how to do it in two words: tell stories, and particularly to young people. And I would like to say, in conclusion, in my view, the concentration of effort should be put on children at the grade school level, fourth, fifth, sixth grade. If you can catch them then, you've got them for life. And I know from experience it works. Those little minds are like sponges, and they want to learn.
That's very similar to some things Herbert Armstrong said over the years, how important it is to teach and to teach when they're very, very young. The thing is, Satan understands this concept well, and he's teaching. He's broadcasting, as Ephesians 2 brings out. And his message, I mean, it's circulating far and wide, and it takes some real diligence. It takes someone willing to submit to the instructions of Deuteronomy 11 and Deuteronomy 30, and you can study Deuteronomy 6 later on your own time, to counteract that. To tell stories to your young people, to tell them to your fourth grader, to get them excited about the books you were excited about when you were their age, and to talk about it. To talk about it over the dinner table. To talk about, as we did last week, the meaning or the significance of the War of Independence. I mean, otherwise, an article comes along like that one from Vox. Here's why we shouldn't have fought the War of Independence. One of probably millions of articles on the internet that are very much like that. Not grounded in history, not grounded in books, biographies. Just a lot of fluff. Just a lot of someone's version of truth. Churchill, as I said on yesterday's show, I mean, he was practically self-educated. In school, he was a flop. In school, he was the last in his class. But he had a remarkable nanny, and then he had one individual, he had one teacher that recognized that he had a special love for history and language. And that one teacher and that one nanny, I mean, they really inspired him. You think about what one person can do. I mean, it's easy to give all the credit to Churchill. I mean, when he was 22, 23, he really did drive himself. When he was assigned to those military operations in India, most of the activities, as I recall, it was late in the afternoon and evening. And he had a lot of downtime in the morning. And he concluded at, I think it was the age of 22, that he really needed to fill his mind, to feed his mind with great works of history and literature, philosophy, all of it, just an incredible range of subjects. Here it is from Brad McDonald's piece, "The Death of Churchillian Leadership." This is from 2006. "As a young soldier in India, Churchill spent hours every day reading books. The discipline of self-education that Winston so passionately and aggressively practiced during those hot Bangalore afternoons remained with him throughout his life. He read ravenously and broadly. I think I read this to you yesterday. But this is all part of why he became such an exceptional leader. He didn't do well in formal education, but he really did love history. And because of that, he had a lot of vision that others didn't have, obviously. You look at the other leaders in the late 1930s. I mean, yeah, they were just marching the nation to war. And Churchill was trying to wake up the entire nation, saying, look, if we don't stop this right now, it's going to lead to another world war. And the men of Munich kept saying, no, this is going to lead to peace. All we need is to have one more discussion with Herr Hitler and everything will be peaceful and we'll come into a period of tranquility. They were wrong. Only Churchill was right. And finally, the people of Britain, they embraced Winston Churchill during their darkest hour. And it was Winston Churchill who led them out of darkness and into that glorious light. Or as he said, those broad, sunlit uplands. It's inspiring history. Do your children know about it? There's lots to tell them. Now there's lots for us to learn about it. But if you seek after this knowledge, this wisdom, God will bless you. God will open your mind to understand. God will help you. I mean, even as I was saying to someone just the other day, even if you're just grounded in the literature that this church produces, like that Royal Vision from December, or the Winston Churchill booklet, or the War Against Sin, or How to Be an Overcomer, all that in there about Napoleon, the science of spiritual warfare. There's quite a lot just in the church library that will really broaden our horizons and deepen our love for history. Paul said to Timothy, this is in 1 Timothy 4, verse 12, let no man despise your youth, but be you an example of the believers, Timothy, in word, in conduct, in charity, in spirit, in faith, in purity. Just be an example, a good example to the believers. You're a young man. So what is it that you really need to do as a young minister, as someone maybe younger than many of the other brethren in the congregation? Well, focus on your example. Focus on your conduct, your words, it says. Loving the people. Walking by faith. And then he continues in verse 13, until I come, give attendance to reading, to exhortation, to doctrine. Devote yourself to reading. That's what it says in the Amplified Version. Really be an avid reader, learner, a disciple, a studier, a researcher. My father makes the point in Malachi's message, the point about the Bereans, that God says they're more noble, Acts 17. They're more noble than the brethren in Thessalonica because they receive the word of God with all readiness of mind, and they searched the Bible daily. They proved everything from the Bible. They knew the Bible. That's why this subject really is so important. Because as I sometimes tell the young people at God's College, if you don't have a love for reading in general, it's really going to work against you when it comes to the daily Bible study that we need to get in, that we have to get in. We have to survive. We've got to love our study sessions. We've got to dig into our study sessions and really learn the ways of God. There's so many examples, as I say, like Winston Churchill, so many of the founding fathers of the United States, great biographies that have been written about them. Mr. Armstrong, in his early days, he talked about the importance of Ben Franklin's autobiography, and I think I touched on this on yesterday's show, but then all these other biographies that he read, and he said about that challenge coming from his relative. He was challenged on the Sabbath from his wife, and then the relative comes along and called him ignorant, and he said that really hit his vanity, because he had been, as he said in his autobiography, pretty well read. Of course, she was saying he was ignorant because he didn't believe in evolution. But how did he respond? How did he react? He hit the library. And he was there, as he says in the autobiography and in Mystery of the Ages, he was out of work at the time. So he was there from mid-morning all the way through till late at night, till past midnight. He was studying. Well, he was at the library until it closed, and then at his apartment studying until well past midnight. You can see why God was able to use individuals like this in such a powerful way. Herbert Armstrong, Winston Churchill. That's why we need to get to know them. That's why we need to learn about them, so that we can follow in that same example, so that we can follow in those same steps. Here again, November, December 2017, the Royal Vision magazine, about those seven steps to building leadership. You're listening to Stephen Fleury. This is the Trumpet Daily Radio Show. If you'd like to send us some feedback, you can email us at td@kpcg.fm. Thank you for joining us today. We'll see you tomorrow.